Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Brains Bible Institute. I'm Pastor Tim Warner. We're in module number 7 on the Apostolic Mission. This will be lesson number 30, which is the 17th part in the section dealing with Paul's ministry. Now, last time we talked a little bit about the Apostle Paul's arrest in Jerusalem when he went to the temple. Now, you may remember that he was going to the temple specifically, or going to Jerusalem specifically, to complete his Nazirite vow. We read in back in chapter 18, flip back there if you would please, Acts chapter 18 and verse 18. It says, and this was towards the end of Paul's second missionary journey. It says, "So Paul still remained a good while. Then he took leave of the brethren and sailed for Syria, and Priscilla and Aquila were with him. He had his hair cut off at Cenchrea, for he had taken a vow." And we talked about the Nazirite vow last time, I believe, in some detail. And he came to Ephesus and left them there and so forth. And we see that he then goes up to Antioch, which is the church, that was his home church where he was sent from. All right, so Paul's missionary journeys are generally reckoned from the time that he would leave Antioch in Syria and go out on a journey, and then he would report back to his sending church in Antioch in Syria at the end of each missionary journey, right? So that was towards the very end of his second missionary journey. He made this vow just before the end of his second missionary journey, shaved his head. And now you may remember that during the Nazirite vow, you set a period of time aside, could be months, could be years, where you did not allow a razor or scissors to cut your hair. And you dedicated yourself to God and you abstained from certain things and whatnot. So Paul, this vow that Paul had made towards the end of his second missionary journey has now been in effect throughout his entire third missionary journey. You may remember this: the third journey, he left Ephesus. I'm sorry, he left Antioch again. He went back, retraced his steps through Asia Minor. He spent a great deal of time in Ephesus, and then he went on and retraced his steps all the way back through Macedonia, Greece, back around again, and now as we've gotten to chapter 21 and 22, we found that he went back through Ephesus again, and then he went back to Jerusalem. And when he got to Jerusalem, he was there to complete his vow. Now, how long was it from the time that he made his vow towards the end of his second missionary journey, and now as he's gone all the back through, retraced his steps all through these areas back, and has gone back through Ephesus and now back through to Jerusalem, how long has it been until he goes back to Jerusalem here and meets with the church? And then, you know, we read about how in chapter 21, how that they had four other men who had taken a similar vow, and their time of completing their vow, their Nazirite vow, was coinciding with Paul's. And so he went to the temple to offer up sacrifices, do the 7 days of purification, and at the end of which the sacrifices would be offered and Paul would shave his head again along with these other men, right? So that was the scenario. So the question now is, how long was it from the time Paul first made his vow at Cenchrea until he now is about to complete his vow? And the answer to that question is, it's been approximately 5 years. 5 years of Paul's third missionary journey, after he went back to Antioch and then and now has done all these other things, from chapter 18 through now we're in chapter 22. We've gone approximately 5 years. Now, you know that hair grows pretty fast, and a man who has not cut his hair for 5 years after shaving his head would have very long hair, probably at least down to the middle of his back, probably maybe even longer than that. All right, so Paul's hair is very long. Now, secondly, He was arrested at the temple during the 7 days of purification prior to him offering the sacrifices. You may remember that the Nazarite vow required that these animals were to be sacrificed, three animals, two baby, a goat and a sheep, and then a full-grown ram were to be sacrificed, and the hair was to be cut and then thrown into the fire during the sacrifice. Now, these sacrifices were done after the 7 days of purification, 7 day ritual of purifying themselves to enter the temple and to complete their vow. Now, if you go back to chapter 21, verse 26, you'll see it says that then Paul took the men, and the next day, having been purified with them, entered the temple to announce the expiration of the days of purification, at which time an offering should be made for each one of them. That is, when the expiration of the days of purification was completed. So they went to the temple to announce the 7 days, and then at the end of that, they were to offer up their sacrifices. Now, verse 27, now when the 7 days were almost ended, and this is a critical statement because what it shows is that Paul was not allowed to actually complete his vow, offer his sacrifices, shave his head, and throw his hair into the fire of the third sacrifice, the sacrifice of the ram, as Numbers says it was to be done. And so it was when the 7 days were almost ended, this is when the Jews from Asia, and we saw last time that these were Jews from Ephesus, which, if you remember, this is where Paul had been very recently, and a lot of conflict took place there between among the Jews there, between those who believed Paul's message of the gospel and those who did not and opposed him. And here they are at the temple in Jerusalem, and they are stirring up trouble, these Jews from Ephesus, stirring up trouble because they knew Paul, and they knew one of the companions that was with Paul, and so forth. So we see that Paul was arrested when the days of purification were almost ended, which means Paul did not cut his hair. So when we get to chapter 22, and the Apostle Paul he's been arrested and he's been handcuffed, and so forth, and now he's been given the opportunity by the Roman soldier to address the crowd. He is addressing the crowd with very long hair, and his very long hair on a Jew at the temple tells them one thing, and that is, this man not only has he taken a Nazarite vow, but he took a very long vow, probably a 5-year vow, to be dedicated to God according to the law of Moses. All right? So what I want to look at now is, as Paul begins his speech and his defense to his fellow Jews, that he's standing there on the steps as a Jew with long hair, 5 years worth of long hair, addressing them, and it's very obvious to them that he took a Nazarite vow. All right? And I think that's probably part of the reason why he was allowed to speak. They actually listened for quite a while to his defense before they finally began to riot again. All right, so let's look now at Paul's defense. I want you to notice in the first few verses that Paul does something very interesting here, and that is, his defense is that he appeals to the Jews at the temple as one of them. He appeals to them as being just like them in many different ways. And by doing so, he is acknowledging them that they are, in fact, you know, zealous for God, you know, and all these things. In verse 1, he addresses them as brethren and fathers, or brothers and fathers. Again, this is a term of respect. It's a familial term. It's a term that shows that he considers himself to be part of the same family which is the children of Abraham through Isaac and Jacob, the 12 tribes of Israel, right? So brothers, meaning all the other Jewish men, and fathers, meaning he's acknowledging with respect the older men as well. Now, also in verse 2, we see that it says that he was speaking to them in the Hebrew language, or the Aramaic language, the language of the Hebrews, the language that was unique to the Hebrews amongst all the other nations around them, which spoke Greek primarily. And so by speaking to them in this, in their language that was considered the language of the Jews, as opposed to the common language of the Gentiles, he is also subtly acknowledging that he is one of them as well, right? So it says that when he spoke to them in the Hebrew language, they kept all the more silent. That's because they wanted to hear what he had to say, because that in and of itself shows that he's identifying with them, right? Now he starts, if you go to verse 3, look how he starts verse 3. He says, I am indeed a Jew born in Damascus of Cilicia. Now, why does he say, I am indeed a Jew? Well, you have to understand the term Jew. The term Jew comes from the word Judah. Judah was one of the tribes of Israel. And Judah was the royal tribe, in fact. But when Solomon sinned against God and his sons, his descendants, who were the kings of Israel, all the kings were of the tribe of Judah, because they had to be a descendant of David, who was of the tribe of Judah. So all these kings, when Solomon sinned against God, and then all of these kings after him sinned against God as well, but God split the nation of Israel into two tribes, two divisions. The northern kingdom was referred to as Israel, or sometimes as Ephraim, which was the name of one of the larger tribes of the northern kingdom. And it consisted of some people say 10 tribes, but really it was only 9.5 tribes, because the tribe of Levi, which served at the temple, a good portion of them stayed with the southern kingdom. So it was 9.5 tribes. And Judah, the largest tribe, which was also the tribe of the kings of Israel, along with the tribe of Benjamin, which was a smaller tribe, a much smaller tribe, but was associated with Judah because of its territory, which was to the south of Jerusalem, like Bethlehem and all down in there. So the tribe of Judah, along with Benjamin and part of Levi, became the southern kingdom. And all through the prophets, from the time of after Solomon, when the prophets addressed the nation of Israel, they would address them as two different entities. They would address them as Judah, the southern tribe of Judah, Benjamin, and part of Levi, and then as Israel or Ephraim, the northern part that as well. All right, so the term Jew in the Bible after that period, in fact, I'm pretty sure that the term Jew is not even used in the Bible until after that period, but I might be mistaken on that. But anyway, it comes from Judah, and it's a reference to the southern kingdom that was not taken captive to Assyria and was allowed to continue after the northern tribes were taken captive, because God, you know, cast them out of his sight because they were completely corrupt and idolatrous. The southern tribes were allowed to continue for a period of time until they became corrupt. Their kings were corrupt, and God sent Nebuchadnezzar, and then we had the 70 years of Babylonian exile. All right. Now, when Paul says, I am indeed a Jew, he literally is identifying himself with the southern kingdom, the royal part of the kingdom, which remained faithful to God for quite a number of years, or at least partly faithful to God, quite a number of years after the northern tribes were taken away. And the northern tribes, part of them became what were referred to as the Samaritans, which were kind of half-breeds, right? So by Paul using this term, "I am indeed a Jew," he is saying, "I'm a pure Jew. I'm a thoroughbred Jew. I'm not a half-breed. I'm not one of those who forsook God and then, only a remnant of their tribes came back. My ancestry has been of those who have remained faithful to God down through the centuries." And of course, this was, the Pharisees and scribes and Pharisees and stuff, they kind of held that term Jew as a good thing, as opposed to all the rest of the Israelites. All right. Now the New Testament, the Gospels, use it in a derogatory way, because the term Jew referred to this group who were antagonistic to Christ and so forth. But it's important that we see that Paul was from this class of Jewish people, and he identifies himself that way. All right, so he continues. He says, "I am indeed a Jew," that is, of the southern kingdom. And then notice he in verse 3, he also adds to that, "brought up in this city," that is, in the city of Jerusalem. So he's saying, "I was not educated amongst the Gentiles. I was not educated in the philosophies of, Plato and the Greeks and their mythologies. I was educated in Jerusalem, the capital of Israel." And not only that, but at the feet of Gamaliel. Now, Gamaliel was a highly, highly respected rabbi. He's mentioned elsewhere. In fact, he was one of the ones who, when the Sanhedrin came together to persecute the Christians shortly after the crucifixion of Christ in the book of Acts, that Gamaliel was one of the ones who stood up and he said, "You be careful. You be careful how you address these Christians." Because essentially he said, "If this thing is from God," in other words, Christianity, the resurrection of Christ and Christianity, "if this thing is from God, you cannot withstand it. But if it's from men," that is, if it's not from God, "then it's gonna self-destruct anyway," right? So you don't need to be whipping and persecuting the apostles. So this Gamaliel was, while he was strict and he was a Pharisee, he also was somewhat cautious about the more zealous, you might say, Pharisees persecuting the Christians. So that's an interesting factor that I think that worked into Paul's education here. All right. Anyway, he says, but look at verse 4. He says, "I persecuted this way to the death, binding and delivering unto prisons both men and women." Now, what Paul is saying by making that statement, he's not proud of the fact that he persecuted Christians. But to this audience, it gave him credibility, because what it shows is that Paul used to be as violently opposed to Christianity as they were. So he's acknowledging to them that, I was exactly like you. I hated these Christians and this group and this message. He says, "I persecuted this way," which was the earliest term for Christianity among the Jews. But notice in verse 5, he says, "As also the high priest bears me witness, and all the council of the elders." Now, look, if they were called to testify, they would have to testify that Paul was one of them, that Saul was used to be one of them. And he goes on to say that, "from whom?" That is, from the elders of the council. "I also received letters to go to the brethren," that means the Jews in Damascus, "and went to Damascus to bring in chains even those who were there to Jerusalem to be punished." So Paul is acknowledging that he was one of them. He was one of those who not only hated the Christians, but was actively involved in persecuting the Christians, and he did so on the authority of the Sanhedrin. Now, beginning in verse 6, Paul, after showing them that he used to be one of them, he used to think exactly like them, he used to be just as zealous for the law of Moses as they were, after showing that he was just like them, he now, beginning in verse 6, begins to tell them why he's no longer like them. What is different about him now as opposed to how he used to be and how they still were, okay? And so he begins to talk about his Damascus Road experience, because that was the turning point in Paul's life, all right? So let's begin reading in verse 6. Now it happened, as I journeyed and came near Damascus at about noon, suddenly a great light from heaven shone around me. And I want you to notice that it says from heaven. Why from heaven? Well, it's important because of the one who's speaking to him, as we'll see in just a moment. Look at verse 7. And I fell to the ground and heard a voice saying to me, quote, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? So I answered, who are you, Lord? And he said to me, I am Jesus of Nazareth, whom you are persecuting. And those who were with me indeed saw the light and were afraid, but they did not hear the voice of him who spoke to me. So I said, what shall I do, Lord? And the Lord said to me, arise and go to Damascus, and there you will be told all things which are appointed for you to do. Now, why do you suppose that Paul made it a point to say that this light came from heaven, that he heard this voice coming from heaven? Well, I think the reason is because he was letting them know that this Jesus who was speaking to them, number one, was alive. Now, they understood that Jesus had been crucified. And so for Paul now to be saying that, you know, he heard, this voice coming from heaven that identified himself as Jesus, the one you're persecuting, obviously meant that Jesus was alive. Well, not only that, but the fact that the voice and the bright light came from heaven was a clear testimony by Paul that Jesus Christ was in heaven. Now, how could Jesus be in heaven? Well, the Jews were familiar with the prophecy in Psalm 110, where the Father says to the Son, that the Lord, Jehovah, said to my Lord, David's Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. And then the next verse goes on to talk about how that this same one was going to rule in the midst of his enemies, which was also a reference back to Psalm chapter 2, that the Son was the one whom God was going to give the kingdom to, and he was going to rule all the nations, right? So what Paul is doing here is he is acknowledging that not only is Jesus alive and he spoke to me, but he spoke to me from heaven, which means he was caught up into heaven, which means he fulfilled Psalm 110:1, which says, where the Father says to him, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool, which also means that he is David's son, because or the Messiah that David considered to be both his son and also to be his Lord or his master in Psalm 110. So by that simple statement, by this simple allusion to Christ as speaking to Paul from heaven and this bright light as coming from heaven, it's acknowledging, Paul is bearing witness to the fact that Jesus was caught up into heaven, that he's the one the Father spoke about to sit at his right hand. He's the one who's going to rule over his enemies. He's the Son of David, and he is the Messiah that David spoke about. All of that is wrapped up in this very simple fact. Now, it's interesting because Stephen, the very one that in Acts chapter 7 that Luke in his book of Acts introduces us to as the first Christian martyr, the Apostle Paul, or at that time Saul, was the one who was consenting to his death. And if you might remember how what it was that finally brought about his execution and Paul consenting to his death. Go back to chapter 7 of Acts for just a moment. And we'll see here that the end of his speech, he was giving a speech or a defense to the Sanhedrin, and he says, verse 52, "Which of the prophets did your fathers not persecute? And they killed those who foretold the coming of the Just One, of whom you now have become the betrayers and murderers, who have received the law by the direction of angels and have not kept it. When they heard these things, they were cut to the heart, and they gnashed at him with their teeth. But he, being full of the Holy Spirit, gazed into heaven, and notice this, and saw the glory of God, and Jesus standing at the right hand of God." Again, this is a testimony to Psalms 110, verse 1, where Jesus is in heaven at the Father's side, which means he's the Messiah, he's the Son of David. And so he said, "Look, I see the heavens opened and the Son of Man standing on the right hand of God." Then they cried out with a loud voice, stopped their ears, and ran at him with one accord, and they cast him out of the city and stoned him. And the witnesses laid down their clothes at the feet of a young man named Saul. Isn't that interesting? And then it goes on to say in just a couple of verses later, chapter 8, verse 1, "Now Saul was consenting to his death." And verse 3, "As for Saul, he made havoc of the church, entering every house and dragging off men and women, committing them to prison." So we see that the persecution that Saul, or Paul now, was famous for was actually instigated by Stephen's testimony that Jesus Christ was in heaven, that not only was he alive, that he had been caught up into heaven, that he was seated at the right hand of the Father, that he was the fulfillment of Psalm 110, verse 1. And so what Saul or Paul now is doing, giving his own defense, because he had a very similar experience to Stephen's. See, Stephen's actually was a faithful one, and he saw Jesus at the right hand of the Father. But Paul, on the other hand, he was not intending to see that, but God showed it to him anyway. And so now he's bearing witness to the very same thing that got Stephen stoned to death. Saul is saying, I saw essentially the same thing Stephen saw. All right, Jesus is alive. Not only is he alive, he's at the Father's right hand in heaven in fulfillment of the prophecy of David in Psalm 110 and verse 1. All right, so now I want you to notice that in verse, back to verse 9, it says, "And those who were with me indeed saw the light." Now, what that essentially means is, you know, when Paul here is calling on others as having the ability to verify what he said. See, if you may notice, all the way back in verse 5, when he's talking about his prior time of persecuting Christians, he says, "As also the high priest bears me witness, and all the council of the elders." That is, you look, you can call them in here to testify, and every one of them will verify that what I'm saying, that I was persecuting them. And now here in verse 9, when he says, "Those who were with me saw the light and were afraid, but they did not hear the voice of him who spoke to me," what he's essentially saying is, look, if you call those who were accompanying me, those who were sent by these high priests, they could testify to the fact that there was indeed a bright light, extremely bright, brighter than the sun, that shone down from heaven, and there was indeed a voice. Now, I want you to pay close attention to the fact that he says they did not hear the voice of him who spoke to me. Now, this passage is sometimes used to show that there's a contradiction in the Bible, in the book of Acts. Those who are skeptics will point to this and say, look here, it says that they didn't hear the voice. But if you go back to Acts chapter 9, where Luke first gives the account of Paul's conversion on the road to Damascus, it says they did hear the voice. So let's look at that. Keep your finger here. go back to Acts chapter 9 and verse 7. It says, and the men who journeyed with him, that is Paul, stood speechless, hearing a voice, but seeing no one. What does Paul say? It says that they saw a light. They didn't see a person, but they saw a light. They saw the bright light, but not hearing the voice of the one speaking to me, is what he says here. And how do we reconcile this fact that Paul says that those accompanying him did not hear the voice in chapter 22, but in chapter 9, Luke says that they heard a voice, but they didn't see anyone. Again, this is presented as proof that the Bible contradicts itself. Well, the answer to that actually is found in the third time that Paul's conversion experience is found in the book of Acts. The third time is when he was on trial before the Gentile rulers, the Roman rulers, and he gives his account again. So let's go there to Acts chapter 26. And let's begin in verse 14. And when we all had fallen, we'll actually go back to 13. At midday, O king, along the road I saw a light from heaven, brighter than the sun, shining around me, and those who journeyed with me. And when we had all fallen to the ground, now that's a new piece of information that's not mentioned previously, but when Paul says that those accompanying him saw the light, he essentially is saying they also fell to the ground when they saw the light, so they could definitely testify to that. I heard a voice, now notice this, I heard a voice speaking to me and saying in the Hebrew language, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? It is hard for you to kick against the goats. Now, in the Hebrew language, again, means, as we said before, it means in the Aramaic language, the language that was special to the Jews and a few other Semitic peoples, but not to the Greeks or Latins and so forth. So when Paul was sent to Damascus by the chief priests and the elders, he was sent with others to accompany him, but very likely these may have actually been Roman officials, or they might have been other civil servants, if you will. But they were not of the religious group which spoke Aramaic. That is, they spoke Greek. They did not speak Aramaic. And so this is why when Paul says in chapter 26, when he says, you know, that that the voice that came from heaven spoke to him in the Hebrew language or in the Aramaic tongue, that tongue special to the, you know, Jews or the more elite Jews, not to the common people who typically spoke Greek. And so that's why back in chapter 22, he says specifically that they in chapter 9, he says they heard a voice. It says they heard a voice. But in chapter 22, notice he says, let me get back to it here. It says, verse 14, that's not it. Where was I? Okay, verse 9, sorry. And those who were with me indeed saw the light and were afraid, but they did not hear the voice of him who spoke to me. Now, the word here is akouo in Greek, and that word is used both for hearing with the ear as well as understanding or comprehending what is being said. The same word is used for both. All right. Now, what Paul is saying here essentially is that they heard a voice, yes, as it says in chapter 9, but they didn't understand what was being said. They weren't actually hearing what was being said because, as he says in chapter 26, that Jesus was speaking to Paul in the Aramaic language, and that's why they didn't understand. Right, so they couldn't testify. See, what Paul is doing here is he's showing that these guys who accompanied me, you could call them to testify, to verify what I'm saying. here that they indeed saw the light. They fell down as though they were dead men, right, in fear. They heard a voice speaking to me, but they did not really hear what was said because it was said to me in Aramaic and they don't speak Aramaic. All right, you guys get that? That's the reason why he said that. So in other words, they could not testify to what was actually being said by the voice, but they could testify to the bright light from heaven and a voice coming from heaven speaking to Paul in a language they didn't understand. They could testify to that. All right, and so this is what Paul is doing constantly throughout this chapter, is he's giving them the source material so that they could verify what he was telling them to be truthful, and if they would simply investigate it. But as we'll see, they were not willing to investigate it, right? All right, so let's move on to beginning in verse 12. We have now Paul talks about this man named Ananias. Then a certain Ananias, a devout man according to the law. Now, why is Paul saying a devout man according to the law? Because, again, he is a highly respected, if they were to investigate, if they were to go and call witnesses from Damascus, they would be able to find this man named Ananias, who was devout, a devout Jew according to the law. That is, he followed the law of Moses perfectly. Nobody could accuse him in any way of not doing so. Yet he was a Christian. So it says, a devout man according to the law, having a good testimony with all the Jews who dwell there. Wow. All right, they couldn't bring any accusations against this man. Anyway, he came to me and he stood and said to me, quote, brother Saul. Again, he's using these familial terms showing that even Ananias, who had a good testimony among all the Jews, calls him brother even after his Damascus Road experience. Brother Saul, receive your sight. And at that same hour, I looked up at him. That is, he was healed and received his sight from this Jewish man. Then he said, the God of our fathers has chosen you that you should know his will. And notice this, see the just one and hear the voice of his mouth. Now, what does he mean, see the just one? Did Paul actually see Jesus on the road to Damascus, or did he just see a bright light that blinded him and hear a voice? All right, well, the fact is the Apostle Paul did in fact see Jesus. In fact, he says in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 that he saw, least of all, he was seen by me after his resurrection, Paul says, when he's talking about Jesus' appearance to the other apostles. All right, so Paul saw Jesus alive. Was it at this instance here on the road to Damascus that Paul saw Jesus? And the answer to that is no, but he did see him later. Let's continue. For you will be his witness to all men of what you have seen and heard. Now, if you go to 2 Corinthians chapter 12, we're not going to turn there because I don't want to use up the rest, a little bit of time I have left there. But if you were to go to 2 Corinthians chapter 12, you would see that Paul talks about the fact that he was in some way caught up into paradise on one occasion, and then on another occasion he was caught up into the third heaven and he saw things that are unlawful to even speak about. Now, something similar to that happened to John. If you read the first chapter of the book of Revelation, and then when you go to chapter 4, he hears a voice from heaven saying, come up here and I'm going to show you things that are going to happen after this. And so John, in his vision, was caught up into heaven and he saw the Father sitting at his throne, and he saw a lamb also on the throne, which was, of course, an allegorical representation of Christ. So the kinds of visions that John had, which he says was in the spirit, which is another way of saying some kind of a spiritual experience that was going on where he was able to communicate directly with Christ. Paul had a similar experience as well. And he's he says that this happened to him. Actually, I tell you what, let's go there just for just a moment, because I want to point this out, because I think it's important that we have the timing of these things correct. In 2 Corinthians chapter 12, Paul talks about this. Oops, I'm in 1 Corinthians. All right, 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 1, it says, "It is doubtless not profitable for me to boast. I will come to visions," notice this, visions, "and revelations of the Lord. I know a man in Christ who 14 years ago," and that's not a good translation, by the way. It literally says before the 14 years. And it doesn't mean 14 years before Paul's writing this letter. It means before a very special period of 14 years, which Paul also talks about in Galatians chapter 1. So he's literally saying, prior to the 14 years that such a one was caught up to the third heaven. "Also, I know such a man, whether in the body or out of the body, I do not know, God knows, how he was caught up into paradise and heard inexpressible words, which is not lawful for man to utter," and so forth. And he goes on to say that Jesus actually spoke to him when he said in verse 9, "And he said to me," quote, you'll see it's in red letters, "My grace is sufficient for you, for my strength is made perfect in weakness," which shows that it was this vision, these visions that Paul had, these two visions, involved Christ himself, all right? Because Christ is speaking to him there. Now, if you go back to Galatians chapter 2, he says, literally it says, 14 years through, "I went up again to Jerusalem with Barnabas and also took Titus with me. And I went up by revelation and communicated to them the gospel which I preach among the Gentiles," and so forth. And he talks about how that he explained to the other apostles the message that Christ had given him to proclaim to the Gentiles. But it's important to know that Paul at this point had not yet begun to preach to the Gentiles. All right. And if you continue reading down through here, you'll see that the other apostles gave him their blessing on this message and said essentially that Peter and the others would go to the Jews, but Paul would from then on go to the Gentiles. He had not yet gone to the Gentiles. And this was 14 years through, that is 14 years. And literally, he's talking about after his conversion. Paul was converted later in the very same year that Jesus was crucified. All right, and so 14 years from that point is when he went up to Jerusalem the second time. And that's when the other apostles gave him their blessing to go and preach to the Gentiles. And it was almost immediately after this, in Acts chapter 13, the first couple of verses, where Paul then and Barnabas left Jerusalem, where they were at the end of this 14-year period. They went up to Antioch again, and almost immediately the church in Antioch, one of the prophets of that church, the holy breath of God spoke through them and said, "Separate to me Paul and Barnabas for the work I have called them to." And so they laid hands on them, and they sent them out on their first missionary journey to the Gentiles. All right? So it's these 14 years. They're kind of like bookends, all right? Paul was converted, and almost immediately on the road to Damascus, the very same year that Jesus was crucified, but much later in the year, and then he went to Arabia, as we read about in Acts, and from there he saw these visions. It was in AD 30, towards the end of that year. And then after this 14-year period, Paul went back to Jerusalem a second time, and it was there that he talks about in Galatians that the other apostles gave him their blessing on the ministry and the message of the gospel. Now, during this 14-year period, we went from Paul being completely ignorant of the gospel to the Gentiles, right? Jesus appeared to him, and he told him he was going to send him to the Gentiles on the road to Damascus, but he didn't have any of the theology yet, right? All the message that Paul taught to the Gentiles, the theology of it, a lot of it was new to them as Jews, because they were you know, the rest of the apostles were under this misconception that, you know, you know, being a Jew was a part of this, and it wasn't. And so Paul's message to the Gentiles now had to do with how they could become pleasing to God, how they could be adopted into Abraham's seed, how they could be have an inheritance among the Jews as well under the new covenant, right? So this is kind of a new phase of theology that is, it's spoken about briefly in the Old Testament in sort of vague terms. In fact, the Apostle Paul talks about this as the mystery. And he talks about it as my gospel because it was something that was revealed to Paul specially by Christ himself during this 14-year period from his conversion, the same year of the crucifixion, the same year of Pentecost, from Paul's conversion until he got the blessing of the other apostles on the mess on this new message to the Gentiles, and then being sent out by the church in Antioch. So this is Paul looks at this period as a 14-year period of his own training. And it's at the end of that 14-year period that Paul then launches out with his message, special message to the Gentiles. All right? And it does not involve keeping the kosher laws, it does not involve keeping the festivals necessarily, and all those other things that we've talked about already in the past. Okay? So this 14-year period, you need to break Paul's ministry down into two periods. All right? The first 14 years is the time of Paul's, he did teach and he did evangelize, but only to the Jews. All right? After the 14-year period, Paul then took his message to the Gentiles and he began the mission that Jesus actually called him for, which was to proclaim the message to the Gentiles. All right, you got that? Now, let's look again at verse All right, so we were talking about Ananias in verse 22 about Paul's conversion. And then it says verse 15, "You will be his witness to all men of what you have seen and heard. And now why are you waiting? Arise and be baptized and wash away your sins, calling on the name of the Lord." Now, this is a very important point because here's Ananias. And we learned from chapter 9 of Acts that Paul was waiting for 3 days after his vision, after he heard the voice, after he acknowledged Jesus as Lord, because he called him Lord. "Lord, what will you have me to do?" Right? And the Lord gave him his future mission. For 3 days, he was blind, and he didn't eat or drink, it says in Acts chapter 9. And then after 3 days, Ananias comes to him, and Ananias says to him, "Arise and be baptized and wash away your sins, calling on the name of the Lord." So, wait a minute. How come Paul wasn't converted on the road to Damascus? How come Paul still had his sins that needed to be washed away 3 days after his Damascus Road experience, 3 days after he acknowledged Jesus as Lord and he believed that Jesus was Lord? What this proves is that the remission of sins, according to Acts chapter 2, verse 38, according to Peter's sermon there, comes when you are baptized after you have believed, after you have repented. And then, at the moment of baptism, that is when the remission of sins takes place. And we also see in Acts chapter 9 that when Ananias came to him after 3 days, he says, "I've come for you, not only for you to be baptized, and also for you to receive the filling of the Holy Spirit." So that happened as well when Paul was baptized. All right? And that's proven by these verses. Don't forget that. All right? What did Jesus say in Mark 16, 16? When he sent the apostles out to proclaim the gospel, he said, "He who believes and is baptized shall be saved." Or the one believing and being baptized, present tense, shall be, future tense, saved. Baptism precedes salvation. Salvation takes place in the water of baptism. All right, it's an important point. that a lot of people overlook. All right, well, let's continue. I just have a, actually, I'm a little long, but I want to finish these few verses. Now it happened when I returned to Jerusalem and was praying in the temple that I was in a trance and saw him, that is Jesus. Now this, when he returned to Jerusalem, this was 3 years after his conversion, which we read about earlier in Acts chapter 9. All right, he says, and saw him, Jesus, saying to me, notice it says he saw him. All right, saying to me, make haste and get out of Jerusalem quickly, for they will not receive your testimony concerning me. So I said, Lord, they know that in every synagogue I imprisoned and beat those who believe on you. And when the blood of your martyr Stephen... Now, isn't this interesting that Paul brings up Stephen's testimony? Look what he says. When the blood of your martyr Stephen was shed, I also was standing by, consenting to his death, and guarding the clothes of those who were killing him. Then he said to me, depart, for I will send you far from here to the Gentiles. Again, reminding him of his ultimate mission, which was not to the Jews, but to the Gentiles. Again, Stephen factors into this because Paul, one of the reasons Paul was raging against Christ and against Christians all the way back there in Acts chapter 7 and 8 and 9 was because of his anger and hatred because these Christians were claiming that this Jesus who was crucified was in heaven, had ascended to heaven, was fulfilling the prophecy of David in Psalm 110 verse 1 that he was seated at the Father's right hand and that Stephen actually could see him in heaven. What blasphemy, Paul thought at that time. And now here he is, an eyewitness to the very same thing that Stephen saw. Isn't that remarkable? Anyway, we'll pick up in verse 22 next time with their reaction to Paul's speech. All right.